I'm Laura Hill here in Chi-Lai, New York with Mrs. Constance Mitchell and Mr. John Mitchell. Today is July 12, 2008. If you could both tell me about your first experiences with activism. How old were you? Where were you? What were the circumstances?
Well, I guess I have to go back to 1950 when John and I first got married. And I was standing on the corner of Maine and Clinton, and Father Quentin Primo, who had a church on Oregon Street, came up to me and said, "You're new in town." And how he knew that, I don't know. But and I said, "Yes, I am." And he started asking me about where I was from and if I liked Rochester. And I said, "No, I didn't." I said, "People here didn't know how to smile, and they weren't friendly at all." And I guess he detected that I was lonesome, that, you know, I really hadn't met that many people except for John's family. Mm-hmm. And next thing I know, he told me about, they gave dances at Baden Street Settlement, mm-hmm. and that he was looking for chaperones for the dances. And so next thing I know, I volunteered. And after that, I joined a group that was at Baden Street called the Delta Wessex, which was a civic group. Mm-hmm. And we used to go out to the migrant camps on Saturday mornings. We tutored the children, and they had a program set up where they worked with the parents and the children, but primarily the children. Mm-hmm. They just didn't have the facilities out there to really work with the parents. The only thing you could talk to them about hygiene and problems that they were having out there, but it was just so congested, and they lived in those old abandoned buses out there, and it was, the living conditions were deplorable. Mm-hmm. But I think that was really my first exposure to really becoming active in the community.
Okay. And Mr. Mitchell?
Same time.
Yeah, same time. I when I first came to Rochester, my dad was employed at Whiting Buick. That's at 30 Norton Street. Mm-hmm. North Washington. North Union Street.
North Union Street.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the I Bank or something, I Institute is there now. But that was the Buick place. And I worked there for about 3 years.
What did you do there?
Well, I started off as a polisher, moved to the paint shop, mm-hmm. and Art Wilbert, who lives out in Webster now, has a junkyard out there, mm-hmm. Taught me how to do body and fender work. So I went right up the ladder. And then noticed I was getting sick to the stomach all the time. Couldn't figure out what was wrong, so I went to my doctor, Dr. Pinker Sobey, and he said to me, "You have painter's colic, and you have to get away from your job." Mm-hmm. So I left and went to General Motors,
okay.
Rochester Products, and stayed there for 36 years. I moved from the factory after 2 years into a salary job, and move in the salary job from the benefit area to hourly employment to hourly benefits mm-hmm. and from benefits right on in to employment. Then I became supervisor of hourly employment and salary, and we moved down to Sibley's, and we were down there for 10 years mm-hmm. on the fifth floor at Sibley's, and I was there as the supervisor of hourly employment and salary employment. And I move everything else from there to my involvement in the community mm-hmm. on at all levels. My wife was involved with ABC, then I got involved with ABC, and then I became a board of directors of Baden Street. My friend Bill Hall, who was the executive director, became executive director during my time. Mm-hmm. And Bill lived right up here on Paul Road until he passed away about a couple of years ago.
Now, neither of you are Rochester natives then. You both came here at some point. Tell me the circumstances surrounding your moving to Rochester.
Well, mine is very simple. I met John. John was stationed in my hometown of New Rochelle, New York, mm-hmm. at Fort Slocum. And the YWCA used to, on Sunday afternoons, used to have what they call the afternoon tea dances out at the fort. Mm-hmm. So they'd come and pick the girls up from the Y, take us out to the port for the dances, and then bring us back after the dance. And that's how I met John. We could give them our first name, but we couldn't give them our last name. But New Rochelle was so small that there was a black man that worked out at the fort, and Johnny asked the man if he knew me, and he said, "That's Aunt Lily's granddaughter." He knew my grandmother, and that's how he called my grandmother up, and my grandmother invited him to dinner. So that's how we met, really, at the dance. Mm-hmm.
Well, she said that I call her and ask her, because I said, "Your granddaughter said to me that she couldn't go out without a chaperone." And I said, "Coming from Louisiana, I'm used to having chaperones." And so I said, "Would you like to go to the movies with us?" "Well, yes, I would." And so
my grandmother.
The reason why I went to see him,
you
because
asked
I was
her grandmother out on a date before you asked her.
No, I asked her. She told me she couldn't go out with me because she had to have a chaperone.
I see.
So
and who was your chaperone?
The chaperone.
Mm-hmm. Who was your chaperone? She said, "My grandmother used my chaperone." And she told me that, I guess, just to throw me off. And I said, "Oh, that's fine." So I called her grandmother and asked her grandmother if she'd go to the movies with her. So I took her to the movies. I never forget. We went to the movies on, what is it, Lincoln?
North Avenue.
North Avenue. And Jordan, what's the guy's name?
Oh, John, I can't remember. Louis Jordan.
Louis Jordan. Was playing as a black cowboy in a black cowboy movie. And we went, and afterward we walked down to the, about a block and a half to the soda fountain place mm-hmm. and had an ice cream soda, and then I got a cab and dropped her off home. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, "What are you doing next Sunday?" And I said, "Nothing." And so she said, "Would you like to come to dinner?" And when I came to dinner, she says to me, "Well, you know, I told my granddaughter, those knuckleheads that she's messing around with, she should ought to leave them alone, and you're a very nice man."
So you listened to your grandma.
So, you know, 2 years later, we ended up getting married. Mm-hmm. I met her in 48. I was, the reason why I met her is because I worked for the general. And I was at Mitchell Pier, Long Island. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, "We're moving." And I said, "Where are we moving to?" He says, "Someplace in New Rochelle. It's called Fort Slocum." And I said, "How do we go there?" And I thought we were going to get a plane, you know, because I'm in the Air Force. And he says, "No." He says, "There's no air base there." He says, "The only thing you can land there and is a helicopter. Helicopter path." Mm-hmm. So we went over in the helicopter path from Mitchell Pier, Long Island. And working for the general, he said to me, "You have to go and get these ladies, and you have to pick this. You have to pick the gentlemen soldiers, because I want these girls to come, have a dance. I want them, everything to go fine. Mm-hmm. You pick out the men." So I had to go in and talk to Mrs. Capanelli, and then I said to her, "How many black girls and how many white girls, you know?" And she says, there was only three white girls and the rest of them were all black. About 12 of them. I said, okay. So I went and I asked my friends to come and meet these girls and to dance with them for a couple of hours. And then we took them to the chow and they had the mess hall food that you usually eat in the Sunday afternoon, you know, cold cuts and all the other stuff. And
honey, excuse me, but you gotta talk all day long. She got ages of questions there.
Oh, okay.
No, no, that's okay. So you came from Louisiana then, that's where your people are from.
Yeah, New Iberia, Louisiana.
Okay. Now, I have heard that a large population of black folk came from New Iberia to Rochester.
Yes.
Why?
No employment.
Okay.
My dad tried to get a job in the shipyards in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was black, they wouldn't hire no blacks in the shipyards in New Orleans. So he had to leave New Iberia, which we were about 100 miles from New Orleans, to go to California, and stayed out in California and had two jobs, because he used to get off of one job at 5 o'clock in the evening, go across the channel on the ferry over to the Catalina Island, and go over and work on the second shipyard job until 12 o'clock at night.
I've been on that ferry. It is very unpleasant. It's very unpleasant.
So, you know, employment. And then when my dad, in 46, when the shipyards closed up in California after the war was over, my dad was out of job again, came back to Louisiana, and I got a letter from my mother saying I was over in Guam, stationed in the Air Force, and said, your dad is going to Rochester, New York, because my brother, Uncle Bill, said there's a lot of employment in Rochester.
And they had found jobs there.
Yeah.
Okay.
So my father came first, stayed here about 4 months, got a job, and was doing well. And then my mother and brother wrote me a letter and said that they were coming to Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came home, we still owned the property in Louisiana, but my home was Rochester, so I came here where my folks were.
Sure. If you both could tell me a little bit about civil rights activism in Rochester before 1964. I understand that you were both members of a group called the Young Turks.
Young Turks?
No, the Nonpartisan Political League and... what was the other group that Gus was head of? I'm trying to think. It wasn't Young Turks.
That's Gus Newport?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you interview him?
I haven't. He's on my list.
Oh, good.
Yeah, he's out in California.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the name of the group. Well, anyway, it was a group of young people in the community that primarily we were looking to do some voter registration and really the housing conditions in the Third Ward at that time were so deplorable. And there were just community issues that we were really, petitions, go take them to city council meetings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a way of getting us active in the community. Actually, my involvement in the whole political arena came through Walter Cooper.
Okay.
You know, Walt Cooper was responsible for me getting involved. And Dick Wade. Dick Wade was a professor at the U of R.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for someone to run for supervisor in the Third Ward. And he came to our meeting of the Delta Essex and said that they were looking for someone. And he said, you know, we recognize that we're not going to get that many men that are going to volunteer to do this. Primarily the men were concerned about their jobs because Rochester was a Republican city and they were really looking for Democrats. And they knew that the men weren't going to jeopardize their jobs because it was a lot of intimidation during that time. I mean, I can tell you a long story about, you know, what I went through.
Tell
just
me.
Being a Democrat the threats. You know, we owned a house on the corner of Greg and Barclay Street over in Cornhill. And I never forget, we had this huge, five-car garage out back. And on top of the garage was this huge chimney, which really was a beacon for the airplanes. It had a light on it and everything. Mm-hmm. And we had heard rumors that the Republicans were going to use that against me when I ran for office, that it was a big eyesore. So we said, well, excuse us, the hell with it, we'll tear the beacon down. So what we did,
we went to
have it
Central Trust. And I'll never forget a man at Central Trust said to me, what do you want the money for? And I said, I need to tear this garage down. My wife is going to run for political office out here. The Republicans are going to make a big stink of it. And he says, well, I'm a Republican too, you know. I said, oh, yeah? Well, then maybe you ought to talk to the people so that I don't have to tear my garage down. He said, no, it's better for me to let you have the money. So I got $1,500 to tear the garage down.
So we tore the garage down with the chimney and everything else. So, well, that won't be a campaign issue. But, I mean, we received so many threats every day. The phone would ring, and people just were so mean and evil, and you just...
They're going to blow the house up. They're going to do this. They're going to do that.
Yeah.
Do you think, and I recognize these are probably difficult to separate, but do you think it was because you were a Democrat, because you were black, because you were a woman?
I think it was a combination of all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, first place, they hadn't had any really viable candidates, you know, that really went after them, to really serious candidates. That was number one. Number two, I just feel that they thought that they could threaten us and we'd just walk away from it.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't know how dedicated and committed we were to what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of us had enough foresight to see that change had to come. We were living in a community that was bursting at the seams because there was not open housing. When John and I bought our house on Greg Street, the real estate agent told us, said, I can't show you houses west of Jefferson Avenue. But it's just not open to blacks.
Mm-hmm.
So that we were confined from Jefferson Avenue back to the river to look for a place to live on the west side of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we wound up over on
Greg Street.
But I think it was because I was black. You know, there hadn't been any blacks. And let me just say this to you. It wasn't just the Republicans. The Democrats were just as adamant about me running, you know, for office and being involved, too. When I first got elected, I went to the first meeting, and I'm sitting there. I walked in, and I got, no one said, have a seat or anything. I said, well, I'll just sit down here in the back of the room. And I never forget, I think his name was Harold Garner. Well, I know.
No, Harold Knopf.
No, it wasn't Knopf. It was the other one who was the majority leader for the Democratic. Well, he was minority leader for the Democrats. And he says, I see we have a nigger in the woodpile. That was his statement. And I just, you know, I just sat there and I said, well, take this, Connie. Keep your mouth shut. Because the time will come when you can tell him off, you know.
Right.
They didn't even have a bathroom upstairs for the county legislators.
Well, they didn't have a restroom for women.
Women. They had a restroom for men. Because all those supervisors were men.
Right.
Okay? So,
well,
the men used to have to stand outside the bathroom to keep the bathroom, keep men from going in. Why she was going in to use the bathroom. They didn't have a ladies' room up there.
Right. Right. Were there ways in which you felt being a woman benefited you in your political career and your activism?
If I reflect back, I'm going to say no. I think being a woman, there was a lot of resentment from men, period, black and white men, mm-hmm. you know. It was just not, it was just men. You know, they had this feeling that women had a place, and it certainly wasn't at the table with them. And I ran into that for a long time until I, you know, you had to almost, you had to prove yourself over and over and over again that you could do what you were set up to do. Mm-hmm. And eventually, and you almost knew when you were accepted, when the curtain went down, you know. And but you know, you eat it. You go, and you know, I never forget. John said to me one day, he said, you know, you put yourself in this position, you got to take what these put on you. And so, you know, don't complain. You're in it now. So either stay in it and bear it or get on out of it. And that was it. And so you just, and if you're stubborn like a mule, you just decide to stay in it and bear it and fight them tooth and nail. And really, I think my going in opened the door for men.
Yeah.
You know, to come through. So that it benefited the men in the long run. Where,
well, I'll never forget the first time Connie ran for office. Lester Peck, who was the druggist on Plymouth Avenue.
No, he was the supervisor, too.
Supervisor, but he was also the druggist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He had a drugstore on Plymouth Avenue in business for the years. He got the sole contract for all the people who were on welfare. They had to go to get medicine from him.
Sure.
And his wife and he would plug them all day long about voting for Lester. And the first time we ran, we said to them, you ought to be ashamed of yourself, selling yourself for a bottle of wine or $2 or something like that. And then we said, we lost the election. And my wife said, the reporter asked her that night, said, what are you planning on doing? She says, first of all, I'm going to send a telegram to my opponent congratulating him on his win. But I'm letting him know that I'm starting my election tomorrow for 2 years from now.
What year is this?
That was, I first ran in 59.
In 59.
And I got
okay.
elected in 61.
In 61.
Oh. So we said, well, we found out what we should do. We said to him, you shouldn't just sell yourself for a bottle of wine. You should ask them to give you, would have been giving you $2, ask for $5.
And still go in there and vote for me.
And then say, then he used to stand outside with a little light showing like this, you know, and say, oh yeah, you all right, you voted.
Uh-huh.
And I said, there's no way in the world he can tell you
how you voted.
How you voted.
Right.
I said, this little light is just a gimmick that he had. Lester Peck, brother-in-law, Charlie, what was Charlie something? But anyway, I said, this is a gimmick he's got. No way he can tell. So the guy, a couple of them we convinced to go in, and when he come out, you know, Lester showed that light on him, and Charlie showed the light on him, and he says, yeah, you okay. And he says, I'm telling you, I know the man told me I was okay. He don't know what the hell he's looking for.
Right. So you had to expose them.
Mm-hmm. We had to expose them. We had
it was the whole education. We, you know, people at that time, you had to take the literacy test, you know.
In New York State?
Yeah.
Okay.
At that time to register to vote. Mm-hmm. And many of my voters, you know, were just one step off the migrant train and had very limited education. Some of them only had first, second, third grade education coming out of Florida because they were bean pickers.
Sure.
So we said we got to find a way to get teach these people. So what we did, I can't remember her name, but this lady that lived over on Eagle Street, we went to her and said we knew that she taught the Lauterbach system, and
okay.
said, you know, if you teach us what you're doing and get a group of us together, we will go and teach. So what we did, we started school right in my living room. And what we did, we'd show people how.
They would ask you is that John Paul Jones was a man in the Navy. What year was John Paul Jones a man in the Navy? In 18 so and so. And the same question was asked over and over again.
Mm-hmm. We tutored people on how to really draw. They didn't know how to write. They drew the answers so that they knew how to draw the answers. Because a lot of them couldn't read and write. And we even did that to help people learn how to get New York State driver's license. We tutored them on how to pass the test. It was amazing. The thing about that was once a person found out that they had a little bit of knowledge, they wanted more.
Sure.
You know? So it was just interesting how we got the city school district, I think, to open up number 3 school or one of the schools for some classes. Mm-hmm. So that it opened up doors for people.
Everybody wanted to get educated.
We could, what we would do, we would give them this little certificate. Once they completed the quarterback system, you swear to God they had went off and got a PhD.
Right. Because that certificate mattered to them. It meant something.
To them, yeah.
Sure. Sure. Who is working on these projects with you?
At that time, there was Dr. Cooper.
Dr. Knox.
Dr. Knox.
Dr.
Bill Lee.
Bill Lee.
David Anderson.
Yeah.
Lakey Ashford.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Clater, Obadiah Williamson. Jesus, how many of those are dead now?
Most of them.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that was really the group that, it was really funny when I finally won.
And Chris Lindley.
Yeah, and Chris.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chris was going, he was teaching at the University of Rochester.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And Dick Wade.
And Dick Wade.
I think Dick was Chris's mentor.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
These are all men.
Yeah. And the thing about it is this, that once we got past that and we won, they said the Republicans were beat by this huge Democratic machine in the Third Ward. I don't think there was 20 of us.
No, there was only 11 of us.
You know, it was just a handful of us. We worked our butts off. But they swore that we had this machine that was...
Oh, they said a machine of about 200 people, you know, defeated the Republicans in the Third Ward.
People were afraid to join up with it. They said, Connie, I can vote for you, but I can't come out openly and support you.
Right.
They were afraid for their jobs.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, as long as you vote for me, I don't care. You know, you don't have to come out openly.
Yeah, you don't actually have to do it publicly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Mr. Mitchell, what was it like to be Connie Mitchell's husband?
Lord, here we go.
Mr. Connie. Kids in even the neighborhood, all the kids, hello, Mr. Connie. How are you, Mr.? I'd say, my name isn't Connie. My name is John. Okay, Mr. Connie, we understand.
Mm-hmm.
So, I just had to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, you know, it got to be humorous to me, and just being, you know, Mr. Connie.
What was that like for you, Mrs. Mitchell?
Well, I didn't like it. I really didn't, you know, and that's why I always tried to make sure that John was included in everything that I did.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt that I never wanted him to have the feeling that he was being put down, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people can be very cruel. And but I couldn't have done what I did without him. I mean, I went into politics and my daughter was only, what, a year old when I went into politics, you know. And if it wasn't for John and his mother and my sister-in-law of taking care of Constance, you know, there's no way on earth that I could have done it. Meetings at night, sitting up writing speeches, and it was a lot of work, you know. Plus, you know, you had your housework to do, the cooking still had to be done. And I come from a long line of eaters, and he loves to eat. So you better have a pot on the stove, regardless what you're doing, you know. And plus, feeding half the neighborhood.
Right.
You know, we fed half It was really.
I said, "Honey, we just bought groceries." Yeah, but she says, "You know, Mr. So and so came by, Mr. So and so, and then their children came by, and this." And I says, "Yeah, but you're feeding the whole third ward." And she says, "Well, what else am I supposed to do? People are hungry."
Right.
I said, "Okay, you know, just keep on doing it."
Right. What was the relationship of the church organizations to politics, to activism at this time?
No.
None.
First place, God rest her soul, Mildred Johnson, I never forget as long as I live. I didn't know Mildred, except I knew that she was very vocal.
Everybody knew she was very vocal.
And everybody said, "Have you met Mildred?" "No, I haven't met Mildred." "Well, you need to meet Mildred." And so she found me, and she came to my house, and she said to me, "I had to come see you. Now, I want to tell you something. You'll make it." And I says, "Why?" "Well, for one thing, you're the right color. You're not black, and you're not too black, and you're not too light. Second thing is that I understand you're Catholic. You're not Baptist. Because, you see, you get caught up in the churches. If you don't belong to the right church, you're going to have some real problems. So I'm glad to hear that you're Catholic." But she was really hilarious, you know. But we became like this, because I always went to her for advice about the community that I didn't know about, you know. And I respected her because Mildred was much older than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I was brought up to, you know, to look up to older people. But she and I used to talk about it. Why won't the church get more involved? You know.
Well, my church, the Catholic Church, Immaculate Conception. My family started going there when my uncle first came to Rochester in 1939.
Mm-hmm.
And they came here to work for the people that owned the Edward Stores. That was the slogans. And they came here, and when the war started, my uncle was told he had to go into defense job. So the slogans owned the car shop out in East Rochester. So my uncle worked in the car shop, and then at night he used to come home, mow the lawn, wash the cars, and they stayed right over the garage at the slogans,
mm-hmm,
on East Avenue. And then my uncle decided he wanted to go into business, so he bought a little store down on Clarissa Street. And later on, he bought a bigger building. And my mother and all of them came, and my uncles and aunts and all of them started coming. And after a while, we had a good portion of the family there.
You had over 200 people from Louisiana,
right,
at that time.
And are they members of Immaculate Conception?
They were at that time, yeah.
All members. Father Reynolds was Monsignor Reynolds.
Mm-hmm.
He was Randall, like a Kodak executive.
Monsignor Randall.
Randall.
Yeah.
He said, "You want to get married on July 4th? I said, "Yes, Father." "The Catholic Church don't marry people on holidays."
"Now they'd be glad that you walk in hell."
I said, "Okay." "Well, what about July 5th? He says, "Yeah, well, I can do it on July 5th. I just can't do it on a holiday."
But they were the pretty much the first largest group of black Catholics in Immaculate. Uh-huh. And in Rochester, you know. Because there weren't that many black Catholics in Rochester at that time. But, the church is always, the Catholic Church has always been active anyway.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a source of activism out in the community, so that wasn't a problem. But I think with the black church, that a lot of what they wanted to do depended on City Hall.
Why?
Well, if they wanted to expand, they had to go to City Hall. If they wanted to have a revival, they had to go to City Hall for permission, you know, which I didn't realize all this politics took place within the church, but I guess it did at that time.
Is this because of zoning laws?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. But it's different today. You know, the black church is more active today. Well, I think Dr. King's the movement forced a lot of the churches to become more active, you know, within the community. Mm-hmm. And I think voter registration did a lot to bring them out mm-hmm. and to the community.
I never forget when we were going to Selma. The first night we got to, was it Montgomery, Alabama? Mm-hmm. Where we had the citizens, the white citizens group, about 15 of them. They're all involved, most of them with the University of Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
The white citizens group.
No, it was the concerned white citizens
yeah.
of Alabama.
And they put us in the back of the station wagon that they had, laid us down, and told us to cover ourselves up because they had a burning on their property of big cross the night before.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody wouldn't see them bringing us in.
Mm-hmm.
We spent the night there that night to be able to get the bus the next day to go out to meet Dr. King and, you know, on the road from Selma.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 nights we spent in the fields. We slept in, and Dr. King says, we're going to get trucks, and the trucks are going to have these honey buckets on them. And he says, one truck will go for the women, one truck will go for the men. And he says, tonight we got the permission, if we go 15 more miles, we got permission to stay in the field. One farmer gave us permission to sleep in his field. And the next night, he says, we should be from Selma to Montgomery, close to it. So we slept in the field that night. And the third night, we got to the Catholic school in Selma. And not in Selma, in Montgomery.
No, in Selma, honey. The Catholic church was in.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway. So Dr. King says, we're going to have several people coming. Big Gregory and a whole lot of other folks are going to come, and they're going to put a show on for us tonight.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, we're going to get some lights from the school. We'll put floodlights out there. We have to have a stage. We couldn't find nothing to build a stage with. So we went to the black funeral director and asked him to let us borrow those big wooden boxes, you know, that they put people in. And that's what we made a stage out of.
You made a stage of caskets?
No.
Casket holders. You know,
the big wooden
okay.
boxes that they
okay.
put the casket
on
in.
On top of, okay, I see.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we made a stage out. I'll never forget Sarah Vaughn and Lena Hone and all of them was there that night. And we had a great time. And it was pouring down, raining. And it was raining
mud,
like mad.
Knee deep in mud.
And you were knee deep in mud, so we took our ponchos
uh-huh.
and sat on our ponchos.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So we wouldn't be sitting in the mud.
What year is this?
This is the march to Selma.
March for months from Selma to Montgomery.
Okay, it's 63, is
yeah.
that right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow. Did you all have a chance to meet Dr. King?
Oh, yes. We met him, and Dr. King said to me, he says, John, he says, you seem to be the one that knows everybody around. He says, you find something for us to have the show tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, okay. And I said, after we looked around, I said, gentlemen, I know what to do. We passed this funeral director, and I seen all these wooden boxes outside. And I said, let's go back. We went back, and we asked him. And he says, well, those boxes are to put caskets in. And I said, yeah, but we need them for a stage tonight.
You know, speaking about Dr. Excuse me, Johnny, but speaking about Dr. King, you know, Dr. King sent his people here, Bevel and Andy Young and all of them, after the riots to work with me.
I'm aware of that. I want to talk to you about that.
Yeah. I worked at Montgomery Neighborhood Center at the time, mm-hmm. and they came to talk to the youth. You know. It was interesting because they had never seen no young people like we were working with. I was working with the youth gangs at the time. As a matter of fact, Darryl Porter was one of the leaders.
He mentioned that.
Yes.
Connie called up. She says to me, "Darryl said he's going to blow up Montgomery Center."
I said,
"What?"
I said, "Darryl, come here. What you going to be, the big bad wolf? You going to huff back? Got all these people in Montgomery Neighborhood Center, the boys sitting up in there scared to death to come out for this little black guy to sit down on the stairs." I said, "Got those people scared to death of you. I'll get some dynamite and blow it up." I said, "First place, you don't know where to go get no dynamite. That's number one. Number two, got all these people scared to death." And they were really frightened after death because he could talk some foolishness, you know.
Well, and this is after the uprising in 64, too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So
if we could go back a little bit in terms of time, I'm very interested in the black Muslim presence in Rochester.
Right.
How does all that come about? I understand it's a very small group of people.
Very small group of people, and people that we knew, you know, personally. Walt Cooper and I knew them. As a matter of fact, we were the only two, I think, that came to their defense. That's another time people were scared to death after they had they broken, you know. The police were wrong, you know. I mean, those people were worshiping. They were afraid of them. You know, there's nothing like fear. And the white community had built up in their mind that there was all these Muslims in Rochester, New York. Probably maybe 10.
Like the Democratic machine in the Third Ward.
But they were afraid of them. So they forced Brother Malcolm into Rochester.
Well, tell me about that. How does that happen?
Well, Brother Malcolm had come out to the University of Rochester. That's how I met him. Freddie Thomas had called me, and I was always interested in black history, and Freddie Thomas was really a scholar on African history. Mm-hmm. So he used to come to the house to really tutor me and give me books to read and whatnot. So he called me, and he said, "You know," he said, "Malcolm X, who's very prominent in the Muslim religion, is going to speak at the University of Rochester. Would you like to go?" And I said, "Oh, I'd love to." So I went. Well, when I got there, Freddie and I think, might have been two or maybe eight blacks. The place was packed with kids, you know, with students. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there were 10 blacks in the whole room.
It's white students.
Yeah.
Who invited him to the University of Rochester?
Some group out from the U of R.
Okay.
So anyway, he spoke, and when he got through speaking, he said, because Freddie and I were sitting down front, he said, "Would you two, the two people right there, would you kindly wait?" He said, so we said, yeah, you know, we were, first place, we were sitting there with our mouth gapped wide open after listening to this man, absolutely enthralled by what he was saying.
What did he say to all those white people that night?
Well, basically, he said, you know, he talked about America and the problems of America and how ignorant Americans were by not taking advantage and knowing what was happening in this country about the racism and how racism was going to bring us down and destroy this country. And, you know, but he had, you know, the students were as same way that we were. I mean, this man was throwing knowledge and statements at us that things you just never even thought about. You know, you might have thought about it, but you never seriously taken it into consideration. He talked about the United States and the relationship we had with Russia, with China. It was absolutely amazing when you go back, you realize today that we had a prophet in our midst who forecast all this that came to pass in America.
He said Russia and the United States would never fight a war because white folks don't fight each other. white folks will join up to fight black folks, red folks, do anything.
Brown folks.
Mm-hmm. They'll never join hands.
And this country was at that was,
eliminate white folks.
Yeah, and at that time, you know, it was the fear that, you know, Russia was going to bomb us and whatnot.
Sure.
So anyway, to make a long story short, after we talked with him, the janitor came, the custodian, and said, you know, I got to close this place up. So I said to him, I said, well, you know, you're welcome to come to my house. Now, this is around about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did. We came to my house, and I got on the phone and called people up and said, you know, if you want to hear Malcolm X, come on over.
Who'd you call?
Oh, who I didn't call. I called Walt Cooper, I called Bill and Bernie.
Oh, you know
what? And I said to them, you call people, call
the,
call
the living room was full of people. My living room was on Greg Street. Was 30
by
18. People were sitting all over the living room, on the floor, everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And we sat up most of the night. I think when everybody went home, it was like 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, you know.
Tell me about the conversation.
Well, people were throwing questions at first. He talked about what he believed in, you know, and it wasn't... Never about religion. It was that was the interesting thing. He never talked about, you know, trying to convince us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing was, and I think we set the tone, because I said to him at that time, I used to smoke. And I said, I smoke, I like pork, and I like a cocktail now and then, so I know I wouldn't make a very good Muslim to begin with. So, and I don't think most people in this room would make good Muslims from what I know of them. But we were interested, you know, in what he had to say. And basically, he talked about America, that this country, how we let the politicians in this country destroy this country, how it's a handful of people in this country who really bring about the hatred and keep that going, and who, in many cases, may not even believe half of what they're spouting out of their mouth, mm-hmm. but because it's advantageous for them to be elected, especially the southern politicians, to talk all that junk that they were talking.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about Russia again. He talked about the relationship with Russia. And he talked about the Middle East. He talked about Iraq and Iran and all that, and said that, you know, eventually we had to recognize these people because we were going to have to depend on these people. And he talked about the oil crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I say so many things that he talked about, we've seen come to pass. And it was just like the man had a...
Every time Malcolm X came to Rochester, he ended up at our house.
How frequently was that?
Well, let's see, 3 or 4 times. The last time he was here was the Wednesday night before he got assassinated. So that was the last time.
Connie has a picture of her and Malcolm and...
Minister Florence
and Doris Price downstairs.
Now let me ask you, what was going on in some of those pictures? I have a beautiful picture that I've got copied from the collections at the University of Rochester, where you have said something, you have kind of a startled look on your face. Malcolm is hysterical laughing next to you, looking at you laughing,
mm-hmm.
and Franklin Florence is kind of standing off to the side looking straight at the camera like he isn't aware of the conversation. Any recollection at all? I wish I'd brought it with me to show you.
I have no idea. That man had a sense of humor that he was with. There was two Malcolms. There was a Malcolm that you got to know, the man. Then there was the Malcolm that was out there for the public. But the Malcolm, the man, would keep you in stitches. Well, Dick Gregory was the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dick Gregory was this very serious man.
Mm-hmm.
Once you got to know him, where he was the comedian out there
right.
for the public. And that Malcolm was just the opposite.
Same way with Dick Gregory. Every time Dick Gregory came to Rochester, he ended up being in our house.
Mm-hmm.
But as a matter of fact, the standing joke among... Irv Carter and Lloyd Stevens, who were the two black detectives in town. Connie, where do you meet all these crazy people?
Well, you know, I was going to ask you, this had to be politically dangerous for you.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, you're running around with Malcolm X.
And Billy Saul Estes was under investigation, which I didn't know. And next thing I know, he's at my house because
Billy Saul Estes. You remember the...
I don't know that name.
Billy Saul Estes, the millionaire from Texas?
He was the one... But see, a lot of people don't know, he's the one that was Minister Florence's mentor. He paid for Minister Florence to go to school.
Okay.
And Minister Florence brought him to our home. So, and we didn't know the FBI and folks were following him. And
Ms. Brown said to me, you know what she says, John? She says, it's odd. Every time Malcolm and I come to your house, this black truck pulls up. And she says, it stays there until usually he pulls away.
I actually was just looking at the FBI files on Malcolm in mm-hmm. Rochester. And every time he was here, whatever he said is in the files. Mm-hmm. Anything that was printed in the local papers, it's in the files.
Well, I found out that they were recording from my house everything Malcolm X said in the living room.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to get those files.
Yeah. Oh, God. I tried to get, what was the FBI man?
Mark Toohey.
Yeah, Mark Toohey. I tried to get Mark Toohey when he was at Kodak to give me the FBI files. Mark Toohey wouldn't. But I called Mark and I said to him, look, I got a friend of mine who came to me and said, Easter Sunday, something is going to happen to my wife. Don't let her go out anywhere. And I said, I'm concerned about it. I called him from GM. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm concerned about it. And I said, so he says, well, I understand Connie's from New Rochelle. I said, yeah. He said, well, maybe it's a good time for her to go see her grandmother and her mother in New Rochelle. Mm-hmm. And so I said to Connie, why don't you go down and visit your mother? You know, I said, it would be nice for you to drop in. So she and my daughter got in the car?
No, fishy. I knew something fishy because that was the first time that he had said for me to go visit my folks. I said, something not right behind this picture, you know.
I'm trying to get out of town because I don't want nothing to happen to her.
Sure.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Do you think Malcolm influenced Rochester, or do you think Rochester influenced Malcolm?
I think Malcolm had a lot of influence on Rochester.
Tell me how.
I think Malcolm killed the stereotypes that people had of him. Mm-hmm. I think that Malcolm, because when he spoke at Cornhill, wherever he spoke, there was just as many whites in the audience as there were blacks. And I think people came because they were curious, and they wanted to see if this man was really a maniac or is this madman or what. And I think that his talks convinced people, this man's not a dummy. And, you know, I may not agree with everything he's saying, but he's certainly putting some food for thought out there. And so I think it changed a lot of people.
Why does that happen in Rochester and not the rest of the country?
Well, you know, let me just say this about Rochester, and I say this to many people, that I think any city in America that, you know, America had problems during the 60s and civil rights problems, and even after the riots, I mean, at least in this city, people came to the table of understanding, you know, what I call it, you know, sat across from each other, tried to come to grips with what took place and how do we resolve it. And I don't think that happened in a lot of other cities. Mm-hmm. I think that Rochester's is something unique about the citizens of this community.
I'm in full agreement with you. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to have a better sense of what that something is.
Well, I think it's a sense of... I think people buy into Rochester. You know, that... they feel they're a part of the city. And I think the politicians make it so that they want to include the public in the decision-making process for Rochester. I think we're small enough that that happens where people begin to feel that way. And I think because of our neighborhood associations, mm-hmm. people take, like, the 19th Ward Association. That's my corner of Rochester, and that's where I'm going to work. You take the South Wedge area. People take that corner, the Park Avenue area.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that helps to develop that feeling that, you know, whatever's wrong here, we can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very strong feeling. I was on United Way Board of Directors for about almost 20 years.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, that was the one thing I found that we could disagree, but eventually we came back full circle to where, well, how do we correct this? If this is a problem, how do we correct it?
Mm-hmm. How does Rochester then get so far gone that you have the uprising in 1964?
I think what happened, nobody wanted to listen. No, those in the decision makers wouldn't listen. The mayor and those people that could have brought some of the change, the industrial leaders, they didn't believe it could happen to Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because Rochester was sort of a control city. The Paul Miller,
mm-hmm.
you know, he considered. This is his Rochester, and how dare those people go out there and tear up my city.
Mm-hmm.
There was that feeling. And I don't think the white community was aware of the number of people that had moved into this community.
Right.
Because they pushed them all over in the Third Ward, you know, people living on top of each other and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that... there's no way on earth that you're going to put that many people together and not think you're going to not have an uprising. What happened, we lived on Gregg Street, and slumlords had taken those great big old mansions and cut them all up and made what they call efficiency apartments,
mm-hmm.
which was just a refrigerator and a two-burner little stove and a room, and that was...
Mm-hmm.
What was it, 48 Gregg Street, that had, what?
18 or 20 mailboxes on it.
On the front of the house. And that's when we knew something was wrong. All of a sudden, all these mailboxes were cropping up on these houses. And we did a lot of voter registration, so we said, all these people can't be living in this one house. And they were.
Mm-hmm.
They had chopped those houses up, chopped the rooms up. They had taken a room that might have been large and made two rooms out of it,
mm-hmm.
so that they could make money.
Right.
And you just don't pile people on top of people like that and not think eventually something's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. And there was not open employment for people.
The only Republican that I can say was really nice to us was Gordon Howell, who was the county executive, county manager at that time. And... Sheriff Al Skinner.
Mm-hmm.
When Skinner came to see Connie and the riot started, he said to her, I can arrange for you if you can get enough toothbrush and stuff. I can arrange for you to see all the people. So Connie went down to the jailhouse and started giving out toothbrushes and toothpaste to people who had been locked up. And, hey, Miss Mitchell, how are you? You know, everybody knew Connie.
Mm-hmm.
And Sheriff Skinner and Gordon Howell, the two honest, fair Republicans that I knew
mm-hmm.
at the time.
I understand you were threatened during the riot. You received threats.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it was the night of the riot. The first threat came in, said, you niggas started it and we're going to finish it, but you're going to be number one. And they were threatening my little girl. So I took my daughter to John's mother and father, and I told him, I said, I got to leave her here.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. These are white people? These are black people? Who?
White people.
White.
Okay.
Good call. Yeah. Said mm-hmm. that...
You niggas started it, we gonna finish it.
Mm-hmm.
And that they were gonna burn up my house and what they were gonna do to my daughter, you know, mm-hmm. what they were gonna do to me. So, but I had received enough threats throughout the years that, it, you know, after a while, it sort of bounces off you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get so frightened until you don't get frightened anymore. And I think that's what happened during that time period, that the fear leaves you. You know, so people, you know, you came to the conclusion that if people want you, they're going to get you. So there's nothing you can do about it anyway.
Right.
I'll never forget the ride started that night, and they called us over. And we were on our way over to the 7th Ward, Joseph Avenue. We got down there by
the train station.
That was the central train station.
Mm-hmm.
And we got right in there. Connie got in the police car, and I'm looking all over for her. And they turned the hose on, you know, the fire department came, turned the hose on people.
Well, that's why I jumped in the police car, because they were hosing people.
And I said to her, I'm looking all over, Connie, and finally she says, I'm in here. And what the hell are you doing in the police car? And she says, well, that's what I thought I'd hide. They were hosing everybody down with water. Mm-hmm. I said, girl, please get out of the police car. They're turning over police cars like mad.
That was not the safest place
to
be.
I said, she's going to the police car. I said, get out of there. I said, will you please? They're turning over cars. Then we get down Joseph Avenue and Lombard. He's supposed to, somebody said he was dead, and then we go up to police headquarters. We get up there to the public safety building. Lombard walks in and he grabs us and he hugs us. Oh, John and Connie, I'm so happy to see you. Please go down there and talk to your people.
He wasn't glad you were safe. He needed you to do some work.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you to pause for just 1 second because we're going to change the tape here.
I'm looking.
With these long-winded folks, you might run out of tape.
We brought extras.
Yes, we brought extras.
Oh, okay.
We brought extras. So we can maybe do this a little later, but do you actually recall the black Muslim trials at Attica?
No.
In 61, I think?
The trial was from the Walt Cooper and I testified at, I think it was after the break-in. Yeah.
So there's two separate things. The black Muslim inmates at Attica bring suit against the state for not allowing them to hold religious services.
Right, yeah.
So I understand that that's actually what brought Malcolm into the area originally. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the four black Muslim trials in Rochester were a separate thing.
Yeah. Walter and I think, were the only lay persons that went, and Jane Goldman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. It was Walter, Jane Goldman, and myself that were character witness for the Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
That's because we knew Wardell and a couple of other people. I don't even remember.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, one of the things that I think is so fascinating about the community's response to those trials are that the incident is sandwiched between Rufus Farewell and A.C. White.
Yeah,
and that really seems to mean something in Rochester at that
moment. Well, see, Rufus Farewell was a good friend of ours.
Police brutality in Rochester was terrible.
Uh-huh.
At that time, they had dogs.
Mm.
And the police, they ran rampant with those dogs. John and I, one night on Plymouth Avenue, saw the police deliberately sick the dogs on some men, you know. And they were standing up there laughing. And, you know, I said, this thing has gotten out of hand. I mean, they were just taking advantage of people. And those dogs never served a purpose in terms of keeping down anything in the community.
It was still more resentment than anything else.
All it did was just force people to hate the police more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think it helped at all.
Mm-hmm.
That's why when the riot started, they didn't give a damn about the police department. The police department show up, he was dead.
Right.
People were bringing all the stuff. They come over and they brought a side of beef. and set it in on our porch and said, "Here, mister, this is your share." Then they brought about 10 cases of liquor, and they brought it in and said, "This is your share."
And what did Mr. Mitchell tell him? Take that stuff
off. Well, you say, she said, "I don't want it. I don't want nothing to have it. Do with it."
They were trying to make up for all those groceries they'd had out of your house.
Yeah, no, they're bringing her a share, you know. Mm-hmm. And she says, "I don't want it. I don't want it. Take it out of there." Then they came down with Fico's safe, and they went back to the house across the street, and you could hear them going back there, bang, bang, bang.
You have to know what Fico is. Fico was a store on Plymouth Avenue.
You could buy everything.
You could buy anything from women, to fur coats, mm-hmm. to anything at that store. Mm-hmm. And they knew it was a lot of corruption that went on in that store, and they knew it was a lot of money in that safe. They banged that safe about 2 hours, and finally they got it open. Once they got it open, you could see them running with the money falling out of their hands. But it was terrible. The riots, you know, when you think back, you could find the humor in it, but it was the sadness. The sadness was to see kids go into the store and all they'd come out with some bologna and some bread or something to mm-hmm. eat, you know? And
what were the stores like? I heard so many contradictory reports. They were Jewish store owners. They had corrupt practices. They were actually Italians. They were good to the kids. I mean,
there was
so
mixing. Like the little store that was down the corner from our house. I used to think he was a good man till I fell in there, and he wouldn't even come and see about me.
She fell on a bottle, and the doctor said she broke her.
The Coxsack Bone.
Coxsack Bone, you know. She fell on the bottles. He had all these empty bottles on the floor. And she stepped on the floor and the bottle went out and she fell back on it. And you know, that man never even came once to the house to see her and never came to the hospital to see her. And told him that she was only doing that for money.
Oh, God.
And she got $2,500. I got $3,500. Because I told him that my wife couldn't perform her duty.
The judge awarded you $3,500?
The court awarded him more money than me.
Because she couldn't perform her duty?
That's right. That's right.
Now, does that tell you something about the times you're living in?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
When a lawyer told him, "Well, John, you can sue too," and told him, I couldn't believe it. I said, "My back is killing me." But you know, that's part of what we had to live through. You know, we've come a long way as a race and as women, mm-hmm. tell you, from when I stop and think, and then we still got a long way to go because yeah. a lot of that mentality is still there, you know. But I'd say this, that a lot of people depended on those stores. They kept accounts at those stores, and those store owners let them build up, you know, like little charge accounts. Mm-hmm. So, because a lot of those people were on welfare, mm-hmm. and their checks didn't come in until the first of the month. So, like, if they ran out of food, they could go in there and they could charge up the food and everything. So, you know, people go in business to make money. That's the bottom line, but it depends on how you treat people too. If you're going to want to take from them, then you got to give something back. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'd say the majority of the store owners had a good working relationship with people. There was a few that were fleecing people, you know, but the majority of those folks really, the fact that they set up those stores in those neighborhoods, they had to have some type of rapport mm-hmm. and feeling for that community. Mm-hmm. So that's my feeling, you know. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
The guy at the liquor store on the corner of Edinburgh and Clarissa Street, Kaplow, mm-hmm. he would allow you to go in and buy all the wine you wanted, and he'd charge you. He'd write it down in the book, and then he wanted to charge you for two bottles, he'd charge you for two. If you got one, you want to charge you for two, you had to pay him. When they started the riot, the first place they broke into was Kaplow's. Mm-hmm. man that cleaned his liquor store out. That's why they brought 10 cases of liquor over to my house, put it in my front yard on my porch, and said, this is your share, Miss Mitchell. And my wife says, get it out of here. I don't want it. So Irv Carter and...
the two detectives said, we'll take it.
They said, oh, no, no, take it and put it over in my car.
They didn't. Oh, my God.
Lombard had sent them over to protect us.
Well, I guess that was part of their pay for that detail.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy, I'm telling you.
So you mentioned earlier that after the rising, after the dust has settled, mm-hmm. Andrew Young and James Bevel come into the mm-hmm. community. Can you tell me how they came in?
Through Mrs. Sibley.
Okay.
And the council churches.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Sibley called me and said that she was going to contact them. And she said, now, Connie, would you have a place for them to stay if I bring them in here to help you?
Mm-hmm.
She wielded a mighty hammer. A lot of people didn't realize that, you know, that old lady worked behind the scenes and did a lot of good for people.
Mm-hmm.
And she's the one that arranged that through the Council of Churches. And they stayed with his uncle and aunt above the restaurant on Clarissa Street.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they stayed. But and they came and they met with the youth and talked to the young people and worked with the young people. So I think they did some good coming into town, you know.
How long were they here?
A little over a week, about 2 weeks, wasn't it?
Yeah, they were here at least 2 weeks or yeah. 3 weeks or something like
two
that.
Weeks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, they say no. We're not gonna come back to Rochester and organize there.
No, because those kids, they didn't want to hear that. First place, you know, the interesting thing about Rochester's young people, they know nothing about the civil rights movement.
Really?
When I got ready to go to Selma, Ms. Mitchell, I worked at Montgomery Neighbor Center, and they said, what are you going down there for? And I said, if I got explained, I shouldn't even be going.
You should be staying right here in Rochester.
Doing a job.
Mm-hmm.
But that's when I realized that those kids had no idea what was going on with the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why the significance of Bevel and Andy Young and all of them coming to help didn't faze them, because they didn't want to hear that. These kids were products of the people that went out there and pitched those bricks.
How can you be... Explain to me how a child can be immune to the civil rights movement at this moment in time. It's all over the news. It's all over the television.
Oh, no, now. But then, at that time...
Those kids weren't watching no television, watching no news, and Mama wasn't talking about it at home, so...
Just no exposure.
Mm-mm. No.
And then, now everybody's and then exposed to it.
The tragedy was you went south, and you saw all these young kids all involved in the movement.
My
parents lived it, you
my,
know.
My aunt, my uncle was black.
Mm-hmm.
My aunt was as spare as you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? All of my mother's brothers and sisters are all real fair.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle used to put his chauffeur's cap on.
Mm-hmm.
My aunt sit in the back seat of the car. They'd stop in the hotel. At that time, you couldn't get a motel or a hotel.
In Mississippi, or when they were going south.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd stop in there, and they'd say, ma'am, madam, I'm working for, with like a hotel room. My aunt would get out of the car. Man would come and he'd pick her bag up, take her bag to the room and do everything. My uncle would go. He'd get himself a room because the only way that he could get a room there is to say he was chauffeuring her.
Right.
Okay, and at night he used to sneak in and go over to her room mm-hmm. and he'd stay with her. Now that's husband and wife.
Right.
Okay? That's the only way you could get a hotel or a motel room. My mother and father traveled to Louisiana, backwards and forwards. They had to drive all the way through or sleep on the road in the car because they couldn't get a hotel. Nobody black could get a hotel or a motel nowhere in the South.
Right.
Now you can,
right.
Everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So there are more people involved today in civil rights than there was then back in those days.
Right. So for Andrew Young and James Bevel, who makes the decision that SCLC is not coming to Rochester? Is it SCLC? Is it the Rochester folks?
I think it was SCLC.
Mm-hmm.
SCLC did come to Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
But Rochester never bought into it. And I think one of the things, Rochester had an NAACP,
right,
active at that time. And I think there was conflict between that group and a new group coming to town. Turfism. That's all it was, you know. And except the NAACP, I hate to say it, they weren't worth 2 cents, because I remember when the mandate came down from national for us to pick at Woolworths on a national level, my cousin called from New Rochelle and said, when are you going to do the picketing? And I said, what picketing? And she says, for Woolworths. She says, your NAACP got notification. I said, no, we didn't. She said, yes, you did. She said, every NAACP in America got notification. Come to find out, our president, who was a little nice white lady, decided that she didn't want Rochester picketing Woolworths, so she didn't let us know.
Who is she?
What was her name? I can't think of her name. She's dead, too. Help me.
I know who it is, but I can't think of
her. I can see her face now.
Mm-hmm.
But she decided that...
She liked Woolworths. And
yeah. She didn't want us out there picketing.
She didn't want us out there picketing Woolworths.
She didn't want you picketing because there would be a picket in Rochester, or specifically something to do with Woolworths?
She had her own reasoning. I think the fact that she didn't want that picketing on Main Street in Rochester.
Mm-hmm. Bad for the image.
Mm-hmm.
So, SCLC is not happening. That's
no.
not going to be the major organizing force in Rochester. Saul Alinsky and Industrial Areas Foundation comes in. How was that decision made?
Well, I was the only female that went out with the ministers to interview Saul Alinsky.
It was an interview process.
Mm-hmm.
Tell
yeah.
me.
Well, that was an interesting...
Went out to Chicago.
Mm-hmm. That was a very interesting... I knew Rochester would never be the same.
Okay.
He, as a matter of fact, he put those ministers through some shock treatment.
I bet he did. Who was on that trip?
Let's see. Canon St. Julian Simpkins,
mm-hmm.
Marv Chandler,
mm-hmm.
Alma Lewis from the Jewish Community Center, Father, what was Father's name? Not Mulcahy. Was it Mulcahy? No, it wasn't Father Mulcahy. It was another priest from the Catholic community, because it was representing each segment of the faith community.
Minister Florence?
No, Minister Florence didn't go.
No, he didn't go?
No, because Minister Florence wasn't even involved. We decided on Minister Florence afterwards to head up fight.
Mm-hmm.
But they
Herb White?
Herb White, yes. Herb White. But I'm trying to think of who the Catholic priest was. That's the only one I can't remember. But...
Thanks.
No.
No, he
Thanks.
Comes later. He's
yeah.
67.
Yeah.
66 or 67.
I can see his face now. It wasn't Mulcahy. But,
Father Spink and Father Greco or something else. Father Spink ended up leaving the Catholic Church and marrying...
Christy.
Yeah. From here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But I always said he was going to leave the church.
So, yeah. So, this meeting, what happens in that meeting?
Well, he acted like he didn't want to come to Rochester, and he wasn't interested in Rochester, you know. It wouldn't be a challenge and everything. He said, all we'd have to do is give everybody baked beans and have them go to the Eastman Theater on when they're having a packed house and everything. And these ministers are looking at him and looking at each other.
He was going to have a fart campaign or something, is what he called it. Sure.
And he just got more obnoxious with each statement that came out of his mouth. And I'm sitting there, and I want to holler laughing, you know? And I said to myself, good Lord, Rochester will never be the same. Well, anyway, we came, after we left Chicago, we decided, and we had mixed emotions. Some said, well, I don't know if this is good for Rochester. Others were saying, well, at least you can give it a try. And others were saying, well, I think we need it. So I said, just what I'm saying to you, well, if he comes, Rochester will never be the same again. We do need organizing. We do need some way to pull that community together. And we came back. Well, the social agencies, like the settlement houses, like Baden Street and Montgomery Neighborhood Center, they were adamant. They didn't want this coming into the community. Well, because it was going to rock the ship, you know, and it was going to change a lot of things that needed to be changed. So it caused a lot of dissent among people in the community because a lot of people were very eager for Fight to come, and then others said, no, I don't want them to come. All they're going to do is just create it and stir up a lot of trouble in the community. But I think it might have been the best thing that ever happened to Rochester.
Yeah.
In terms of the employment picture, especially, because they opened that door to Kodak. And once Kodak opened the door, the other companies opened the door automatically.
How did black folk respond to being organized by these two white men, Solinsky and Ed Chambers?
Well, they didn't even look upon it as being organized by Ed Chambers or Solinsky, because what happened, Minister Florence was so dynamic, and he was the right person at the right time when we decided on him. And he had this leadership quality, you know, and he took the helm immediately, and so you never thought about...
So Fight became more Florence than it came...
It became Minister Florence's organization,
it
you know.
Became
Excuse
more
me,
Florence.
Johnny, I think my daughter is... You know, I think that back door is locked. Is that Constance?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, okay, sure. She'll come if you knock. But, all right. That door is, excuse me. What's her name?
Phyllis.
Could you open that back door for me, please?
Oh, it is open, it sounds like.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, daughter.
How you doing?
So, Fight becomes Florence's baby from the start.
Yeah.
But how did you all, what process did you go through to decide upon him?
Well, I think that what we had to do was look at, to see who had the leadership qualities that could really take the helm, and who had respect within the community. We looked at, you know, certain criteria that were built in that this person need to have, and could take the helm immediately and get that ship to rolling. So, and Minister Florence's name came up with everyone.
What had he done to prove himself in those ways?
Well, he had been very active and vocal in the Rufus Farewell situation. And one other incident, it was...
Well, the Kodak situation, when went down to New Jersey.
But that was after Fight was formed, honey.
Yeah, but I
but
mean...
But I'm talking about prior to that.
Well, Florence
but
he had been
active in the community.
Active in the community,
the voter
and
registration
very well
and
known.
Everything. So, you know, and he was well known.
So,
And the main thing, you wanted someone... within the black community that the blacks could appreciate and follow.
Absolutely.
You know, and he was the person that everyone felt was ideal for, you know. Plus, they felt that he could work well with whites. So
they thought that about Florence?
Yeah.
Wow, that is the first time I've heard that.
Yeah, they thought that he could work well with whites.
And that was...
For Friends of Fight. With Ed Chambers.
Important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. What was the relationship between Florence and Alinsky and Chambers like?
They had a good working relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Florence never bit his tongue, you know, and neither did Saul Alinsky.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might have been some problems with Ed Chambers.
Okay.
But I think that was resolved between Alinsky and...
Mm-hmm.
Because they began a good working relationship,
mm-hmm.
you know. And... you know, a lot of people within Fight couldn't stand Ed Chambers.
Really?
Well, because he came in and they felt that he came in and they didn't realize that he, in a sense, was Florence's boss because mm-hmm. he was Alinsky's voice in Rochester.
Right.
But they resented the fact that he came in and sort of told Florence what to do and how to do it. And what it was basically to discuss new approaches and how to do it and whatnot. And they didn't understand how that whole setup was. I mean, I could see it,
mm-hmm.
you know, but and a lot of other people could see it, but a lot of people at the bottom rung of that ladder in Fight just couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
And they resented it,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
so tell me then what Fight starts to do. I have a lot of material on the struggle with Kodak,
yeah.
the Flemington, New Jersey event. But on the ground, what are they doing in the community? How do they begin that organizing process?
Well, you know, at the time I worked for Montgomery Neighbors Center.
Mm-hmm.
And part of my responsibility at Montgomery was to form block associations.
Okay.
So I gave them all my Southwest block associations. I didn't give it to them. I just said to the people in the organization, Fight is here now. You really need to join. To be
mm-hmm.
part of this community-wide organization, and they did. I think if all of them joined except one. I think the Favors. Yes, they did join eventually, and that was. It wasn't so much they didn't want to join. It was two people that didn't like Minister Barnes that didn't want to.
Right.
You know.
Personal
but,
politics.
Personal politics, and but they joined, and so that's what happened. The where they had block associations. They immediately joined, so that gave them a core group of people to start working with.
Mm-hmm.
And they began to do much of what I had already been doing through Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my argument has always been that if you're going to organize people, you organize them in small groups, and you address all the issues that are at their front door and back door before you go out to the broader community.
Mm-hmm.
People want to know why they're not picking up my garbage and
mm-hmm.
all the little issues that concern them in their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, then you can go to city council and start complaining about something else.
So Fight is not necessarily an organization of individuals.
No.
It is an organization of other organizations.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And they joined. They became the Katy Street Block Association, the Favor Street Block Association, the Champagne.
You know how we started those block associations?
Tell me.
We went to people and talked to them about joining up as a block association, but joining up primarily to be concerned about the living condition that they had in their immediate residence.
Mm-hmm.
Then we started getting flower seeds and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
And we started planting flowers. And as the flowers came up in the yard, the people saw what the Block Association could do.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, "Ooh, you got nice flowers in your yard." And we said, "Yes." And then the next thing you know, we able to get them more involved in other things.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And we got them involved in politics, and we got them involved in education, and we got them involved more in the schools.
Sure.
And, you know, being concerned about
mm-hmm.
their children and to how much their kids were learning in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the kind of teachers that the kids had.
Sure.
And so, you know, you build on things like that, and you have to start small.
Mm-hmm.
In order to build those things up to those kinds of things that you want to.
And does FIGHT operate on that same basis, the starting small and then building up?
You mean today?
No, FIGHT, the organization, in 65 when they start.
Well, no, they wanted to be, global.
Mm-hmm.
But the people in the organizations did that work, the crunch work.
For them?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's who did it.
Okay. So what does FIGHT do? What's their impact?
I think FIGHT became an image organization.
All right.
I think that it stood for a lot of things that it didn't do.
Like what?
Well, one, it stood for opening the door to employment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what opened the door to employment was going to Flemington and bringing Kodak to its knees. And then when Kodak was brought to his knees, all of a sudden General Motors and Strong and everybody else said, if they can bring Kodak to their knees, they can bring us to a knee. So maybe we need to open this door a little bit wider and offer some more entry-level jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the manufacturing community came together and said, let's make sure this door stays open now that it's open.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it was so much FIGHT doing that. I think that what FIGHT forced their hand in Flemington, and I think Kodak and the manufacturers decided to open up that door afterwards. Because if they didn't want to do it, it wouldn't have opened.
Well, Jack Costello had a lot to do with it, too.
Well, sure, I know that. The industrial management, I worked for IMC, mm-hmm. And I know how much influence they had in terms of opening up that door of the meetings that they had.
So they opened the door because they're afraid?
I think it was out of fear.
Mm-hmm.
They knew what had already happened in Rochester, and, took Rochester a hell of a long time to live down that riot,
mm-hmm.
Because it was a community that, people could bet money they would have said it never would happen in Rochester.
Right.
But Rochester's an image city. The fathers like to think of it as a good city, and it is. It is a good city, mm-hmm. It's a city that had problems, and it still has problems. I look right now, and I think, good Lord.
I've been watching the local news the last couple of nights.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Don't even start me on Rochester today. I get sick when I think about it,
Mm-hmm.
And because nobody is going out here addressing really the core of the problem. You're going to clean up Conkey Avenue, and all you're going to do is send the shooters over to the next two blocks.
That's right. That's right.
And that's the sad part. But,
yeah.
but I don't even want to get on that subject because I get really upset about it. And I said, I'm too old to worry about that.
Somebody else has to pick up the...
Let somebody else worry about
pick
that.
Pick up the banner. So if FIGHT is an image organization, it sounds like what you're saying then is they use that image to push the doors open.
Yeah, for the good of the community.
They instill some fear.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. And I think you had to have that for change to come about. Because, let's face it, you didn't need no high school education to drop a screw in a hole and turn it four or five times with a screwdriver.
Right.
And, those companies had that strict rule that you had to have a high school diploma to get an entry-level job at these companies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you didn't need that, to put a widget on a conveyor belt and have it go down the line,
right.
And somebody else,
right.
You put the screw in, somebody else turned the screw.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the door, once it was open, and once they found out that these folks could be productive workers,
mm-hmm.
that they had an asset that they didn't even realize that they had. I did the training through Industrial Management Council for supervisors training.
Mm-hmm.
For the managers and supervisors that was going to, work with these newcomers. And it was really pathetic, the lack of communication between the company and that person who had to take these people and have these people do the job. It was really sad because a lot of the supervisors were scared to death with these folks coming in. You know, they had all these stereotypes up in their head. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of these new workers coming in, they had to become acclimated to industry.
Right.
So.
Right. Is FIGHT a civil rights organization or a black power organization?
I'd say black power.
Why?
I don't think it's a civil rights organization. I think it was an organization built to present, to show how powerful you can be within the community if you organize. I don't think it addressed the day-to-day civil rights responsibilities that went along with, say, an NAACP
mm-hmm.
or a SNCC or
okay.
an SCLC. I think it was more of economic power. How do you get the jobs? How do you change the power structure so that you can almost force them to bring about change in a community?
Well, you know, she was Bill Johnson's campaign manager.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew when Bill was running in the primary, he was running against 15, 20 candidates at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew then that Bill would win, and we knew doggone well that we had the community organized enough to be concerned. I think the city passed up a golden opportunity when having Bill in there for 12 years like they had him, they didn't use Bill the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Duffy is trying to do it now. Duffy will never be able to do it. Not the black community.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people in the community just don't trust him. I don't know why.
Well, I think you got to remember that Duffy was affiliated with the police department.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think I know why, but
all
I mean,
right. So
yeah.
I mean,
right, sure.
And
okay.
Daryl, you know, as much I love Daryl, just like he's my own child.
He said the same thing about you, just like his own mother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but Daryl, you know, doesn't have that much credibility in the community either because he's building it slowly but surely, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when Duffy hired Daryl, there were people that said, to do what? Follow him around?
What are his qualifications for this position? Right.
And even, you know, the irony of it was that even black folks were beginning to question, to do what? You know, he's hiring him, but he's hiring him to do what? And until today, I really don't know what Daryl's job is with the city of Rochester. I know what Gene Howard's job is. I know what somebody else's job. But I don't know what Daryl's job is. I know that wherever you don't see Duffy, or you see Duffy, you'll see Daryl. He's sort of like the replacement. I'm here because the mayor can't come today.
Mm-hmm.
Bit. But I don't know what his job is with the city. I'm glad to see him with a job, and I'm glad to see him making some money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I don't know what his job is with the city of Rochester.
Hmm. That's interesting. So, if FIGHT is a black power organization, how does it negotiate the backlash to black power in this era, late 1960s, early 70s? How does it manage to survive and be effective?
I think that FIGHT came at a time, and I think it came at the right time. It served its purpose, and I think that was it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was a permanent fixture within this community.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. I think it came to serve a purpose, was put in place, and it did serve the purpose. But I don't think it was set up to be an organization that would be here permanently.
See, once the industry started employing more blacks and professional blacks that they brought in from around the country,
mm-hmm.
and started to put these old people here, the power of FIGHT became strictly...
It got diminished.
Yeah, the non-educated black folks. The Urban League started.
Picked up the banner.
And picked up the banner and started coming in and bringing in more of the middle or professional blacks into the Urban League.
Mm-hmm.
If you look on the Urban League incorporation papers, you'll see my name there.
I
was on the first, one of the first people in Rochester to push the Urban League.
What?
Because I realized then that you needed to have a professional black group to deal with all the black professionals we had coming in.
But there's only so many entry-level jobs in a community anyway.
Yeah.
Let's face it. And I think that there'll always be people coming into the community who need entry-level positions. But I think the bulk of the entry-level positions that industry sort of absorbed when they first came, Rochester Products, Delco, and these companies took folks in, put them on the conveyor belts.
Well, I know, I hired about 10,000 people. Of the 10,000 people that I hired, 50% of them were black and 50% of them were white.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for Rochester Jobs Incorporated for, 10 years before I went to the Industrial Management Council. And in those 10 years, I put over 12,000 people to work in entry-level positions.
See, it's really interesting to hear you two talk about this stuff. I understand that there's a great deal of conflict in this period between organizations, the turfism, right, that you're referring
to.
What is the relationship between FIGHT and Rochester Jobs Incorporated, or RJI?
I think that there was some basic resentment. Mr. Croft worked directly with Kodak.
Ed Croft?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He worked directly with the industrial leaders.
Mm-hmm.
RJI was founded by the industrial leaders. They put the money up. It was their organization. And the whole purpose of RJI was to hire and train entry-level workers so that they could melt into FIGHT didn't have capacity to do that, had nothing in place to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did they do the training, but I mean, we did the supervisory training of managers and supervisors and built up programs so that they could understand the workforce and to have some empathy and understanding of this person that was coming in to the workforce. FIGHT wasn't set up to do that.
Would you have an RJI if FIGHT hadn't come first? How come?
I think RJI would have.
No, RJI came first.
RJI came first.
RJI is an outgrowth of the meeting out at Colgate Divinity School right after the riots.
Okay.
So RJI came first.
The way I understood the chronology was that I understand that meeting at Colgate took place.
Yes.
I thought it was in response to the battle between FIGHT and Kodak.
No.
That Florence was involved in RJI, that he threatened a number of times to pull out of RJI's creation, and that was a rather contentious process.
Florence couldn't threaten that because, you see, money had to come to FIGHT.
Mm-hmm.
And money was coming from the Council of Churches.
Mm-hmm. I didn't mean he... He threatened to bring it to an end. The newspaper articles or the accounts I've read of it suggest that he was going to pull his name from it. And then if he pulled his name from it, he was pulling FIGHT's name from it. And then as an organization, it lost credibility in the community.
Mr. Croft, Ed Croft and Mr. Florence was like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I worked for RJI, so I can tell you that I can't believe everything you're reading in this big
Sure.
that's not true. Minister Florence used to do an awful lot of threatening.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
We've heard a little bit about that.
He would threaten them. And he'd scare some folks, I guess, you know. But, and maybe, I used to call it the evil eye. He'd give the people that evil look. But, now, if you didn't know him, you might be afraid of him, you know. You might be afraid of what he could do. But a lot of that was tactics, you know, that was applied. And, you know, I sit back sometime and I think about those days, and I have to find all the humor in it. I said, because if you don't, you want to sit down and go somewhere and cry.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of it had to do with, it was a power play, you know. Mr. Croft was resented because he was an old white man that, who does he think he is, you know, he's telling us what to do. Mm-hmm. But Croft knew about as much about the black community as Mr. Florence did. Mm-hmm. Because I used to marvel. I'd go to work and he'd sit down and tell me things about the black community that I didn't know.
Right.
So I said, who in the hell is feeding you this?
A lot of times when the newspaper thought there was a battle going on between Ed Croft and Minister Florence, mm-hmm. there really wasn't. Mm-hmm. That was a stage thing.
Okay.
To give more power to whoever was seeking the power.
They, you know, a lot of games were played during that time. Not all of it you like to think about.
Mm-hmm.
But
why do you think Bernie Gifford got involved with fight organization?
Well,
because Bernie was involved with the University of Rochester.
I would like to know what you think about that.
Hmm?
Like to know what you all think about that.
Well, I can tell you what I think. I know, it to, in a sense, that, who was the president of UVAR? What was his name? Help me.
Alan K. Wallace.
Okay.
He was the one that, you know, that was Bernie's man. And he convinced the powers that be that, you know, you needed an intelligent, smart, articulate, young black man in that position. And they bought into it.
Not a rabble rouser like Florence. And
that's right.
Okay.
And so that's how, you know, he got into it.
Was that good or bad for the community?
Good.
I think at the time it was good.
Okay.
I do. I think that Bernie was needed.
Mm-hmm.
You needed almost a peacekeeper because there had been so much bad feelings on both sides. Mm-hmm. You almost needed Bernie to come in at that time. And there was, you know, some terrible time between him and Florence.
Tell me about them.
Well, I'll tell you, Florence had some folks around him. Joe Lawson, I forget, coming that night waving that gun, and the man knocked me out the way to get up underneath the desk. I was trying to hide up underneath the desk.
Where? When is this? What is
when
this?
The fight was on Prospect Street.
Going to Prospect and Adam.
We were in there having a meeting. And the next thing I know, Joe Lawson came in there and waving that gun. And all I saw was gun. And I said, well, there's a metal desk I'm going up underneath. But before I could get up underneath it, the guy used to work at Fight, Mother lived over in Plymouth Gardens. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, he beat me up underneath. I told him, move.
He beat you under the desk?
Threw me out the way.
So Joe Lawson is coming in with a gun. Why?
Well, he was coming in because he didn't like the way things were going, and he came in to change things, and I don't know how he was going to change them, but I know I was getting myself out of the way.
What year is this?
Oh, Lord, this is
right after Bernie took over.
So 67, 68, I think is when Bernie took over.
Whenever it was.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Oh, maybe it's a little later. Maybe it's 69.
I don't know, Jeff.
Alan K. Wallace was the key to the whole Bernie's whole background. Alan K. Wallace was the man who was calling the shots.
Well, it wasn't so much Alan K. Wallace calling the shots. I think
the people who were Alan K. Wallace.
Yeah, because you had the Kodak heads and folks that represented Xerox, and you know you had
Bausch and Lomb and everybody else.
You had industrial heads that got their heads together on Monday morning
because they wanted Florence out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Bad influence on this community. Setting a bad image for Rochester, New York. Mm-hmm.
But there is obviously some reception to that in the black communities as well.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, how does...
The black community started saying, you know, that white folks is running fight. And what Bernie had to do was to go out there and show them that, no, you know, you got to bring in... We got to bring in more black intelligent people in order to be able to show these people that we can do things.
Not only that, Bernie's argument was that Florence was turning everybody off.
Yeah.
How does Florence fall from grace? How does that happen? I mean, he's the darling for so long.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's really sad, and I keep saying this, I've said this to anybody that wants to listen. We've honored so many people in Rochester. We've never really given this man the accolades that he deserves.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was a tremendous influence on the change that came about within this community. His leadership qualities, and he came at the right time, served the purpose, you know, and you know, there's a time and place for everything, and nobody likes to fall from grace. And if they do, they like to fall gracefully.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but... to have it snatched away from you, there's bound to be resentment.
Mm-hmm.
But we still owe him a debt of gratitude that we've never really given him.
Yeah.
You know, and I just, you know, I've said it to many people, but nobody picks up on it, so. And I, you know, it's one of those things you just can't do by yourself.
Right.
But I think it's long overdue.
So, Bernie Gifford is there for less than a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then Raymond Scott becomes the president.
Mm-hmm.
What were those years like? I mean, he's 5 years, I think, he remains the president.
Yeah, but fights started going down then.
I think people began to lose, you know, you gain supporters, and Minister Flores had a lot of support within the black community. And he had a lot of support within the white community, too.
Mm-hmm.
Friends of Fight was very active with Minister Florence, you know, and interacted with him. And so I think you lost a lot of his supporters. And then when Bernie came on, he had his supporters, but when he left, his supporters went by the wayside. So Scotty picked up the remnants, mm-hmm. you know. And Scotty brought a different type of leadership, you know. Much different than either one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think Fight had lost a lot. The wind had been knocked out of Fight. The programs just weren't there.
How does that happen?
Well, I think the funding.
The money.
I think the funding.
Tell me how that happens. How do they lose the money? I realize the Council of Churches is done after 3 years.
Yeah.
The industries stopped funding.
Well, not only that, but I think what happened... they have the buildings over there. What are the on Joseph Avenue?
The Fight Village.
Yeah, the Fight Village. Mm-hmm. I think Minister Florence took over that
mm-hmm.
as part of his job and responsibility. So I think it got piecemealed out. You know, the important part of Fight, and I think Fight got diluted. Mm-hmm. Don't you think? And I don't think the dollars were coming in. Nobody didn't have a very strong, active organization to go after the dollars that needed to run an organization like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the terrible, you know, everybody want to be the chief, nobody want to be the Indian. That's the other side of the fence, too.
My dad used to say that all the time. All the time.
You know, everybody want to be boss.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody can be boss. And so that posed some real problems there, too. And because I never forget... I had, you know, some problems with some of the people in Fight, and when I worked at RJI, and I had to really go, you know, they were condemning me through RJI, and I said, well, I want to meet with him. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell him the truth. And Ed Croft told me, well, Connie, you don't need to go. I'm going to go tell him the truth. The truth was that it was Ed Croft and Don Bergen from Lincoln Rochester that put the money to keep Fight from going under.
Was Fight, I mean, after the Council of Churches stops funding mm-hmm. them, after Industrial Areas Foundation is mm-hmm. out of the picture, were they constantly on the verge of financial crisis?
Constantly.
Is that mismanagement? Is mismanagement. That the nature of the beast?
Yeah. Well, I think it's
well, Scotty wasn't in the...
Well, it wasn't only Scotty, though, Johnny.
No, but I mean, he had... what you call him with him? What's the guy name?
Wally.
Wally. But, you know, they... Scotty's got a lot of strength. But Scotty's strength is not...
There are too many people on the payroll and not enough money to keep them people going. That's what it was. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. But I do know, personally, that the money that did come in through Don Bergen and Ed Croft. But money was funneled, but they didn't want nobody to know they were funneling the money into to Fight, to keep Fight going,
right.
You know.
Right.
And... I went over there and spilled the beans. I said, you're sitting up here talking about me. If it wasn't for me, you wouldn't have a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I was helping keep their job going by convincing Don Bergen to keep funding it.
Yeah.
You know?
So, at the end of Fight's decade, they sell off Fight-On.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes L-Trex.
Right.
And the Fight organization reportedly receives about $40,000.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to that money?
Nobody's ever known. Nobody's ever known. That's the tragedy that, you know, there's been a lot of accusations, but nobody ever knew what happened to the money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God rest his soul, DeLeon McEwen, you know, he said, I'm not taking the blame in it. Nobody think I stole the money. He said, because I didn't. But he was, you know, they were accusing him at one time.
I don't know. Something happened there between Scotty and Miss Wallace. And, you know, the money just disappeared.
Somebody got it, but I don't know who got it.
Mm-hmm.
And but when things like that happen, you could kill your organization automatically dead.
Yeah.
It's automatically dead, you know?
You can't recover from that.
No, not from that, no.
You see, the other thing was this, is that Matt Augustine was the real smart guy. Of course, he had a master's degree, and he guessed he was smarter.
Well, Matt is a businessman.
Matt is a strictly businessman, you know?
And,
he's a graduate of Harvard.
Mm-hmm. And he... you know, he don't play around. He's all business.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So when Matt Augustine takes over Fight-On and it becomes L-Trex, absolutely everybody along the way has said Matt Augustine is a businessman, and
mm-hmm.
that's how he ran it. It
right.
was no longer a social agency.
That's right.
It was a business.
That's right.
And so as a business, being
mm-hmm.
run by a businessman, does it still fulfill its purpose?
I think it fulfills its purpose because he's hired and done some beautiful things with his people.
Okay.
He's hired, you know, a core group of people in the community, people that for the first time in their life they're able to send their kids off to school.
Mm-hmm.
He sets up packages within his company that I think they all take a cruise together. There's things that they're doing like one big family. You
it's
know?
A quality of life.
Yeah.
It's not just a job.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the people that work for him love him,
mm-hmm.
you know, love the organization. So he's done an outstanding job.
Yeah, because the guy, he set up education funds, he set up health funds, he set up, you know, workman compensation funds, and he set up all of these things for people
mm-hmm.
and made people have input into it to ask for what they wanted.
Yeah, he makes them feel they're a part of the
And he makes them feel that they're a part of the organization.
So it sounds to me like much of the spirit of Fight,
mm-hmm.
much of the purpose of Fight still lives
in
that company.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And what about Fight Village?
I don't know. I know they had some problems a couple of years ago, but I don't, you know, I haven't really
kept
track.
They were having some mortgage problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
I think the people that had living there just couldn't pay the rent.
Right.
But so I think Minister Clarence still runs it, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's still on the board of directors.
Yeah, he's still on the board of directors. Yeah.
So, Mrs. Mitchell, if we could just return for a little bit more to your political career. Mm-hmm. I don't have a firm sense on your chronology. You run for ward supervisor in 59 and lose. Mm-hmm. You run again in 61. Mm-hmm. You win. Right. How long are you ward supervisor?
I was ward supervisor and during the time that I ran. So I'd say from 58, 59, 60.
61,
63, 60, 60, 64. 60.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Bob Bennett, remember, came in?
Yeah, Bob Bennett.
I think Bob came in 60. Wait a minute.
That can't be right.
No, it's not
no,
right.
No, Bob Bennett came in 60.
After I won.
Yeah, after
because
you won.
Because you're ward supervisor during the uprising.
Yeah.
So that's 61 until at least 65. To 65.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you run for city council.
Yeah, and I won, lost, tied, and lost by 2 votes.
Tell me about that election to Chris, with Chris.
Well, you know, I love Chris, and Chris did a lot for me, and that's why I didn't pursue that in the courts, because we had all kinds of evidence that election was stolen from me, you know?
But my daughter was in college at Drexel University.
No, she was at Xavier when...
No, that's right. She was at Xavier, New Orleans. She sent her ballot
absentee
in.
My neighbor's absentee ballot. Sent theirs in from college.
Absentee ballot. My daughter's ballot never arrived.
My neighbor's daughter's
ballot never arrived. They arrived. They got put into a trash can. And the guy called me up and he said to me, I work for the Board of Election. I ain't going
to
tell you who he is.
You don't need to.
But he called me up and he says, could you meet me at Don and Bob's?
He says, remember?
Yeah. He says, behind Don and Bob. I'm going to pull up in my car, and we're going to pull up, and you're going to pull up in your car. I'm going to be facing one way, you're going to be facing the other way. I'm going to talk to you from the car. And I'm going to tell you what's happened to your wife, and she's going to lose the election. And I said, no, she isn't, because they announced that she was the winner. And they said, no, she's going to lose, and she's going to lose.
They threw away my absentee ballots.
And they burned her absentee ballots in this ballot can. He says, I can show you the can if you want to see it. I said, what good is it for me to see it? I came back and I said to her, you know, you're going to lose the election.
Let's go back and talk about how we even get to absentee ballots, because they don't typically count them. So what transpires prior to that?
Well, the night of election night, I had won.
Okay.
The next morning, I was tied. A day or two later, I was 2 votes. Chris won by 2 votes.
And this was all announced publicly?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so how did they explain that?
Larry Kerwin was running the Democratic Party.
And Chris liked this.
And Larry Kerwin and Chris were like Siamese twins.
Mm-hmm. This is very, very interesting.
Yeah. So I said, you know, I'm a firm believer what's for you, you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And it just wasn't for me to have it. And the best thing ever happened to me was to get the hell out of
Well, you know, we got...
I'm sorry.
Oh, we have to change the tape here real quick.
This is a good point.
Oh, good Lord. Good Lord. So in 65, you're out, you're done?
Mm-hmm.
No more.
I said, yeah, I was out. That's it.
Well, we were out because we got Willie Lightfoot involved.
I got other people involved.
Is he still alive?
Ron Kilpatrick.
I thought so.
Mm-hmm. Ron Kilpatrick got involved for the 1 year.
There's another guy on the other side of town who runs the same election year you do.
David Gant?
Maxwell Walters.
No, those were neither of the two names. What was the name?
Ron Thomas?
Yes. Say it again.
Ron Thomas.
Maybe that was it. He's running in a different ward.
It was Maxwell Walters who ran in 59 with me.
No. I mean for city council. In 65.
Oh, Ron Good.
Ron Good. That's it. I thought it was Good. Ron Good.
Yeah.
Same thing happens, right? He has a tied primary race, and then he ends up...
Oh, he wins because Ron, they figured it was well, Ron wasn't as tied in to the fight organization and all of the others. So Ron was considered to be more acceptable.
Well, he's safer. He's not Connie Mitchell.
Okay.
Yeah, of course.
So Larry Kerwin said, I don't care what you do, Connie Mitchell can't win this election.
And Larry Kerwin is the head of the Democratic Party.
He was the chairman at that time.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So how...
But he owns an insurance company in this town.
Okay.
Okay, and he had all the insurance with the city administration.
Mm-hmm.
Larry Kerwin owned control all of
it. I think that they were really in state of shock. No way on earth did they think that I would come that close to beating Chris.
Well, you did beat him.
Yeah, and I did beat him. And, you know, that's why I laughed, because I said, I'm looking at, I love Hillary Clinton, but then, if somebody had told that lady a year ago that little black man would come up and be the presidential candidate.
She would have fallen over.
It's his time, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a time and there's a place for everything that happens, and people have to accept that, you know.
I'm hoping Obama wins, because God Almighty, we can't afford to have another Republican.
Well, I just watch the news footage and I think, how can he not win?
Well,
you know, let's face it.
You know,
this is America.
This is America. Anything can happen.
Uh-huh.
You know.
You see the other day what happened to his plane?
No.
The plane got the tails.
No, wasn't it the front end of the plane?
Well, no, the back end of the plane, the chute that's supposed to open up inside the plane.
Oh, good Lord.
And then the front end of the plane got
like
pushed
got
in.
Matched in. So I said, oh, Lord, they're
while you're flying in the air.
They're starting already.
Yeah.
So
it's that's interesting what I worry that you bring about. This up. What does the assassinations of Dr. King and Malcolm X do to Rochester? What's the response to those two things?
Well, I don't know about other people. I know Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, well, the Kennedys, I don't think people realize what was taken out of people. You know, I think back to JFK's assassination and what we went through as a country. And then I realized we've been through hell in this country, you know, and how it drains people. And yet, you know, it forces people to stop and lose faith, and then they come back and fight twice as hard.
Mm-hmm.
But my fear is, and I tell this to John all the time, my fear with Obama is that some nut is going to try to kill him. And if they do, that this country is in deep trouble.
It is.
Because it's not only black folks in America. America has woke up that this is a country, a diverse country, and this man represents both the black and white of America.
Yeah.
And that the Lord sent this young man. This is what I keep saying to John, that people don't want to believe this, but I really believe that this man has been put in this space and in this time to straighten us out as a country.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. I just believe that we need him to help straighten this country out, because we are in deep trouble. We're hated around the world. You know, and we don't want to talk to nobody. Don't talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you don't communicate with folks, you're never going to.
Right.
You know, I mean, we just can't go to war just because we don't have the energy or the strength or the people to go to war with Iran anyway. And that's what frightens me now with this mess. We're dealing with a bunch of nuts sitting in Washington.
Yeah.
who don't care about people.
So, well, you can see that. Well, look at Halliburton. Halliburton started 200 companies. They got the security. They bring their GI's food. They wash the GI's clothes. They do everything. Mm-hmm. The government, they transport all the stuff. Halliburton, 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 but all the different companies. But all companies by Halliburton. No bidding, no nothing. They just submit. Then Halliburton said, the government said to Halliburton, you charge us too much money. You saw the overcharge us by $200 million. Oh yeah, well, we found that area. We'll send you the 200. Well, we'll keep the 200. You just ship back the stuff to us. You know.
Yeah, there are certainly a lot of problems.
Our vice president is chairman of the board of Halliburton. He's chairman of the board of Halliburton now in disguise. And he and Bush then got to be billionaires since they got to be president.
I don't even care about the money. You know, really, if they want to fleece the people, go fleece them. But I don't put the whole country in jeopardy because you want to fleece
them. Well, look at the number of people who lost their homes through foreclosure.
That's true.
I mean, for the first time.
And then they estimate something like 40 million more people in this country may lose their house coming this year. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, that's crazy.
Well, we're in deep trouble, I tell you, financially in this country, because food prices have shot through the roof.
Gas prices are out of...
This is a good point for this. It is tragic in this country, mm-hmm. but it is worse in many, many other places.
Oh, yes, Lord, yes.
And so it sounds to me like you were saying that much of what Malcolm was trying to do in this period mm-hmm. is to say we are setting the stage for very dangerous international, global
That's right.
proportions.
Yeah.
How is Rochester, in its own humble mm-hmm. way, a player in the international context at this time? Is it?
I don't think it is, really. I think when you really stop and think about it, because Kodak has lost its power.
RG&E's lost their power.
Getting ready to be...
Taken over.
Really, the only one that has the global effect right now is Xerox.
Okay. And back in this era? In 1965, when Malcolm is talking mm-hmm. about America in a global context, yeah. when he's delivering that speech at Cornhill, how did Rochester envision its place in the global arena?
Oh, I think Rochester saw itself through Bosch and Lomb, Kodak, mm-hmm. General Motors.
Mm-hmm.
We had, you know, the big guns here in town.
Mm-hmm.
But when you stop and think about the layoffs in these companies, probably half the workforce that they had then
is no longer.
Not here.
Did the black...
Well, like at one time had 50,000 employees. Right now they only got about something like 12 or 14,000.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, those numbers were absolutely astonishing. 40,000, mm-hmm. 50,000 employees in a city like Rochester.
Well, look at Rochester Products, I remember, because I hired mm-hmm. 10,000 people myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was personnel director over there, and
yeah.
I hired 10,000 people. We had three shifts. We had about 4,000 people working on three shifts,
mm-hmm.
and we kept the place going. Now, Delphi came in, and Delphi took over. Delphi, half the time is closed.
You know,
the money isn't there.
The thing that puzzles me and has me baffled is that we have so much brain power in America. And somehow, I don't know where it is, you know.
hiding in universities.
We got a dummy running the country.
We have so many brilliant people in this country. Mm-hmm. And even right here in Rochester, we have some brilliant people in Rochester.
Right.
I don't know why people just have given up or what it is. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the clock and seeing how much time I've taken up from you all today. What are the things that we haven't covered that you think are absolutely critical to understanding this period? What have I missed?
I think education.
Tell me about education.
I think that we've done a grave injustice to the young people that are no longer young within this community. You know, I go back to when my daughter started school. My daughter's 50 years old. And we lived in the third ward. And I remember someone saying to me, is Constance going to go to number three school? I said, hell no, she's going to Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
Now that goes back a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, there's been problems within that city school district. When I worked for the Industrial Management Council, my job was I was executive director of the prison program, which was the science and math program.
Yeah.
And we, God rest his soul, Josh Lofton, I remember saying to him, because when he retired, he came to work for me, and I said to him, I said, Josh, I said, is there some way we can find out who's failing and who's, you know, making it in the city? He said, yeah, he said, they don't like to give that out. He said, but I'll get you a copy. He got the computer printout. I brought them things home and spread them out on my dining room table at the other house. And I sat there and cried like a baby. The kids were failing. Across the board, F, D, F, D, F, D, F, D, down the line, right? I said, Josh, the kids are all failing. He said, well, I don't want to tell you. He said, I figure I'll let you find out for yourself. Our kids have been failing for so long. It's just a handful of kids that make it through that district and graduate and can go on to higher education. I don't know what it is. I don't want to blame it on the teachers. I don't want to blame it on the system. There's something radically wrong with the system. Something really wrong.
It's interesting that you bring this up because it has been said that fight is one of the reasons that education in the city is so bad. That fight decided what the priorities were going to be for Rochester, and education was not on their list of priorities.
Could be, because education is definitely one of the problems that I've seen. And I know that kids, you can change. You know, when I first started the prison program, and I never forget the first meeting I had with the kids, two little girls, about 13 years old, got up in the back of the room and raised their hand. I said, yeah. Ms. Mitchell, my mother said to tell you hello. She said that she was in your program at Montgomery Neighborhood Center. Well, I knew when soon she said that. She was in the unwed program, so she couldn't be no more than, if she was 13, her mother was probably 26, 27 years old. And that was a problem then, and I said, this thing has got to be fixed. First, I called all the parents and I said, your kids cannot be in prison if you don't participate. Your kids will not get summer intern jobs if you don't participate. And when I say participate, I mean show up for these meetings. And, you know, at first they just didn't pay me no attention. When them kids went back and told their mother, well, I'm not getting no summer jobs, Ms. Mitchell said, you didn't show up at no meeting. Honey, I had parents look at me dead in my face and pull those parents together and got those kids tutored where they needed the tutoring. Changed their mentality that they could learn, and it was the greatest joy of my life when my first batch of kids graduated from high school and I had scholarships. I had joined the National Association of Pre-College Directors and got scholarships in schools across the country, and when I saw them kids leaving out of here, and then I had worked with the schools so that I said, our kids can't afford to travel, so don't give me no scholarship to the University of Las Vegas because my kid can't get to Nevada. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, suppose we arrange for travel money and whatnot. And they built in packages. And when I got those kids out of here, it just did my heart so much good to see those kids go up to college, see those kids come back 4 years later. You know, but they ain't come back to Rochester. That's the sad
part. I was going to ask.
They ain't come back.
There's no employment here. Why would they want to come back?
Sure. And then not only that, they wanted to go elsewhere. And that's human nature, you know. But, I mean, I had hoped that they would come back, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. They scattered around America because what happened, they became bright kids and they were recruited by the companies.
Sure.
You know, so to me, education is the key, and I just, you know, I don't see it being a top priority. If you look at the city school district, I mean, they brought in a new superintendent, and hopefully I'm praying to God that, you know, he can do some good, but it's not up to him.
You know, education, of course, was on the table at this time. Integration plans, busing
mm-hmm.
plans.
Yeah.
I read some interview notes from an interview that you had done mm-hmm. where you said, I'm not for busing.
No.
I don't think that's a solution.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that come from? What did you see as the solution at that time?
Well, first place, I don't think nobody has to go cross town sitting next to no little white child to learn.
Mm-hmm.
that's just, to me, and I don't even call that integration because when they first had the first integration, which was school 3 and 30, and I never forget it as long as I live, they put them kids in a bus, take them over to number 30 school, take them to the gymnasium, and then they let them go into class. At noontime, they fed those kids in the gymnasium. At 3 o'clock, they put them kids back on the bus and brought them back to the third ward. Now, if you call that integration, and to me, integration is mingling, living by each other, beginning to know each other, and there's no way, you know.
You're never going to gain integration and by busing kids from one spot to another and then bringing them back at home at night
so
they come back to the same environment that they left that morning.
You have to melt them into the school system. And I can use my grandson as an example. He went to West Irondequoit
mm-hmm.
On that urban-suburban program.
Mm-hmm.
But he got on a bus every morning, went down to Main Street, got the bus, went on out to West Irondequoit, went to school bright and early. But he got a better education out there than I'm sure he would have got from Wilson
mm-hmm.
or Franklin or any of these schools in the city. You know,
he's a nuclear submarine man now, and he's studying engineering.
Mm-hmm. So, you know,
he just got transferred over to Hawaii so mm-hmm. he could continue his education program.
But, you know, and that's the sad part of it is that, you know, the other people don't feel the same way as I do, but I just believe very strongly that kids can learn if you develop the mindset. And you have to make them feel that they can learn. You have to instill in them that they want to learn. And you got to do some exciting things with them, you know. We used to always have the competition between the schools,
mm-hmm.
you know, and things like that.
Sure.
But everybody do what they got to do, you know. And I'm sure when I'm dead and gone, they're still going to be arguing about whether...
Not in our lifetimes. Thank you guys so much for
Listen,
doing this
thanks
with me.
For coming.
I really
hope we got something out of it. I mean, we talk to you to death.
No, it's fantastic. We laughed on the way over here that 2 hours wasn't going to be enough. I had my four lists, you know, four
mm-hmm.
pages of questions, and I'm thrilled that you both talked to us today.
Well, I'm
it's
glad
real nice.
That you were able to come.
I know you must be tired of telling these same stories over and
yeah,
over.
It's, you know, and I said to him the other day, I said, the lady's coming Saturday. He said, what you want to talk about? Same old thing.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
I hate to say that.
It's true.
But, you know,
it's, true.
It's been told so many times. And
did you ever see the movie 64 Riot?
Yeah, I saw the documentary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They did a nice job with that.
They did
mm-hmm.
a nice job.
Yeah.
Yep, I saw it. I mean, there's plenty of material out there for me to write my dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like I, you know, needed to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to tell you that there is no public space for people to hear your stories. Mm-hmm. You know, they can go watch a documentary,
yeah.
but they get maybe 10 or 15 minutes of
right.
your story of what
mm-hmm.
you said. And so one of the reasons we've done this project is to make this public mm-hmm. repository for people to have access to these right. stories long after, you know, you all are gone.
Right.
And it's unfortunate because so many of the stories were not told before
yeah.
people passed
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
It's really too bad.
Mm-hmm.
So now when somebody calls you, you can send them to the University of Rochester
okay,
to
great.
Hear your...
I will do that.
I already did it. It's on tape there.
Well, it's nice meeting both of you.
It's very nice
and good
to meet
luck
you.
To you.
Mrs. Mitchell, what have you done with all your papers?